Hello and welcome to A-Team Group's podcast on the outlook for risk regulation and sustainability in 2019, brought to you from our Trading Tech Summit in London on February the 27th. The podcast focuses on the operational complexity of the finance industry and the risk of loss from inadequate internal processes or external events such as Brexit, world politics, regulation, increasing sanctions and fines, and the ever-present threat of cyber attacks. Listen to our keynote speaker, Beata Born, Executive Director of Risk and Regulatory Management at UBS Wealth Management, to find out more about these challenges and how the industry can address them.
Well, hello everyone, and thanks for coming, thanks for listening to this. To the organizers, thanks for letting me open this day today. I think we're going to have a lot of very interesting talks and panels and discussions. I'm glad to be able to set the stage for basically everything we're talking about. We're talking about tech, we're talking about new solutions, and why are we talking about those new solutions? Because we need to deal with complexity. I'm an operational risk manager, so I come from the operational risk space, which essentially means I have to deal with a lot of complexity. I need solutions for complexity. So we're going to be looking at five sections. So this presentation has got about 70 pages, so prepare for a lot of speed reading. No, just kidding. I won't go into every single detail of it. There's also another one that you will be able to get as a PDF version with a lot more information on, you know, the equivalence, passporting, single market, all of that, if you're interested in it. But today I'll just make some main points. So we'll start out in general with what's operational risk and why are we looking at it and what exactly are we looking at in terms of complexity. We're focusing on the external factors. Section two is the beefy one. Here, this one ends with Brexit, and it starts out with why did we get to where we are now, and what sort of the setup of the EU and the EEA in the single marketplace, what role does passporting and equivalence play, et cetera, et cetera. I'll give you some juicy details on what are we doing at UBS. I actually failed to mention that earlier. I have been the Global MiFID II project lead at UBS, and very recently, about 9 months ago, ended up being the Brexit program lead as well. It just so happened that I was standing in the hallway when people needed a Brexit program lead. So here I am. So I'll give you some info on that and what we're doing, what we're struggling with. Section 3 and 4 and 5, I'll keep quite short. There are other examples of complexity. We've got a sustainability topic coming up, not sustainability in the sense of what do we need to do to be sustainable ourselves, but what do we need to do to keep our planet sustainable, and that seems to be also a responsibility for the financial services industry in the future. So we'll talk a little bit about that. One quick example on how complex it actually is to implement a regulation within a firm, and then the tech piece I will probably mostly leave to everybody that comes after me, because they will be much more suited to do that. So let's jump in. Operational risk is essentially the risk of loss resulting from inadequate or failed internal processes, people, systems, or from external events. Official definition, important is the external events. You all know these pieces. You know, we've got the systems, the people, the processes, the culture, and the external influences. So far, at least from my experience in the last 12 years at UBS, we've been focusing a whole lot on these pieces, on you know, processes and the systems being stable, and which is still important, don't get me wrong, the culture not being a risk culture, etc. In the last 10 years or so, I think it's become more and more important to look at what happens on the outside, the geopolitical developments. We've got, you know, Trump building a wall and imposing trade tariffs on China. We've got Brexit. We've got the regulatory environment that is just out of control at the moment. More and more regulations coming up. Okay, we can hardly deal with them all, then leading to sanctions and fines. We've got the whole issue around cybersecurity, privacy, transparency. So everything that comes from the outside is creating more and more work for us, and it seems as though there's a lot more responsibility put on our on our organizations for the greater good of the international community. So we'll start with what I'll do is I'll in these external factors, I will deep dive into a couple of those to just give a couple of examples as to what that actually means for us. And this is, you all know this, it's just not new, it's just a bit of food for thought to not lose the big picture when we're dealing with solutions and when we're thinking about how are we going to deal with this threat. It makes sense to, for regulatory purposes, for example, to think about what's the spirit of the regulations, why are we doing this, where do we want to actually get to, what's the 80-20 rule, which market do we actually want to be present in, rather than just seeing a small problem and just jumping straight in. So I think sometimes it makes sense to step back, look at the big picture, and then see where it comes from and what can we do about it. So we'll talk about globalization, the EU, single market passporting, and Brexit. Now, globalization has given us a lot of good things. It's given us a lot of freedom. It's given us the open global market, fostered integration of countries, like constructs like the EU and the EA that we have. We've got the internet. We've got endless information sharing. But it's also given us a global financial crisis. It's given us a lot of easily spread terrorism, it's given us fraud, identity theft, it's given us easy access and implementation of propaganda. So the pendulum of globalization has sort of gone all the way in one direction, and it's now going all the way in the other direction. And what that means is we've got reactions such as I mentioned, Brexit, taking back control, people wanting to get rid of this complexity. They can't deal with it anymore, so they want to just be within their own borders and make sure what's closest to them works, understandable to a certain degree. And it's also given us an influx of regulations. Because everything was opened up, a lot of negative reactions came up, so now regulators are trying to control all of it. That restricts, obviously, the market activities again, puts the rules around it, gives us more complexity. So here we are with the complexity again. Now, the rules, we're talking about countries and governments and regulators. What does that actually look like? We talk about the EU, and everybody knows what the EU is. Everybody knows what the EEA is. And I'm sure you are all aware of that as well. But just a very quick refresher. We've got the EEA, and it's got 31 members, 27 of which are part of the EU, 19 are part of the Eurozone, 3 are part of the EFTA, and 4 are part of the G20. Now, 4 EFTA members, one of them is Switzerland, it's not part of the EEA. Everybody that wants to be part of the EU also has to be part of the EEA. And everybody that's in the Eurozone is also in the EU. So you see, it is easy, but it's not quite that easy. And then we'll get to, this is essentially the main piece of what I'm trying to come up with this presentation. So we have big groups that come up with goals, with very good goals. For example, in 2009, the G20 decided we're going to make the derivatives market more stable. And then there was MiFID, and then there was FinFRAC, and then there was EMIR, and then there was Dodd-Frank. So what happened is it was decided over here, where is this? Over here in this piece, derivatives market. We then went into here, and everybody went on their own way and said, okay, well, we're going to implement it this way, and we're going to implement it this way, and this is this law, and we're going to be done in 2020, we're going to be done in 2016, etc., etc. And then everybody realized that's really complex, so we're trying to make it less complex by building little buckets again. So we've got stuff like the single market, we've got equivalence provisions, we've got the passporting, the EU regulations versus directive. So the ESMA can say, well, this is a regulation, everybody has to implement the same thing. And the directives then gives the local NCA the discretion to implement as however they want, right? So here we've got a little bit of freedom within a big pot of rules. Also, again, complexity. If you're a global bank and you're trying to figure out what France does and what Germany does, they're all in the EU. So who is the regulator? Is it ESMA? Is it BaFin? Is it AMF? And so on. And then we also got the bilateral agreements for everybody that's not in the EA, or not in that group. Quick refresher on the single European market. Eliminates borders for all goods and services. It can be accessed by EEA members only. We still need a passport to access it, and that's important. The local NCA, so the local regulator, will give a passport to the local firm to access another European market. And that is not just given to the firm, it's given for specific services to the firm. It can only be granted within the EEA, and it's granted to firms and not countries, also important. We also will look at quickly at what the difference is between subsidiaries and branches in this regard, because that gives non-EEA firms the opportunity to access the single market by implementing subsidiaries in the EEA. Might be interesting for the UK in the future. And then we'll quickly look at what that means for UK passports. So now we're looking at those two pieces. Back to our complexity picture. Don't worry about it. Really, really, really busy slide. I played with colors. You can read it in your free time. Important is we've got over here a German NCA, gives a passport to the German bank. German bank then can go into the Spanish market, Italian market, whichever market. Does not work on non-EA. Example, America. Same, the German NCA can't give the German bank a passport to go to the American market, so outside of the EEA. Quite obvious. Where does passporting apply? Only in the EEA, not the G20, not the EFTA. Now, branches versus subsidiaries. A branch operates under the jurisdiction of the home country, which means it's basically just an extension of the original firm. A subsidiary, on the other hand, operates under the jurisdiction of the host country. So if the let's say there's a Japanese firm. Don't look at the picture again. Sorry. There's a Japanese firm that has a subsidiary in Spain. Then that subsidiary from Japan operates under the Spanish jurisdiction, can therefore also get a passport to access other European countries, which is what a lot of firms have done in the UK. The UK financial market is a very attractive location, or has been a very attractive location, because there's a lot of talent, there's great infrastructure, the language, everybody speaks English, most people speak English, so it's really easy to set up an international business in a country where you've got, you know, the talent pool, the infrastructure, and also the ability to communicate. And chances are, with Brexit, that's going to diminish. And even if, you know, we don't know when the Brexit's going to happen, if it's going to happen, even if it doesn't, it's already, firms are already starting to move out, obviously. A couple of numbers. The FCA has granted 5,500 firms that has granted passports. There's way more passports because they're for different services. But 5,500 firms will be affected in the UK. And then also, this doesn't just affect the UK, obviously. Other European firms cannot access the UK market anymore either. So the other way around, EEA NCAs have granted passports to 8,000 firms. So all of that will go away when Brexit happens, if it happens. Quickly, equivalence. What's the difference between equivalence and passporting? Everything, essentially. Equivalence is granted to a country, not to a firm. Equivalence is based on specific pieces of specific regulations. It cannot cover a whole regulation. It is not a single market access. It will never be a single market access. And it can be revoked. It's subject to change. So in terms of Brexit, there's a lot of talk about equivalence. It will not really solve the problem. Even if the EU gives equivalence for all 40 provisions, there are only 40, to the UK, it will not solve a problem. It doesn't mean our MIFID is compliant with UK MIFID and EMIR and so on. So it helps, but it's not a silver bullet, definitely not. So that's where the equivalence provisions are, obviously. Again, equivalence only the outside of the EU, that's where it applies. Before I move over to Brexit, Any questions on my rant on the EU and the single market? Okay, so we're now all refreshed in terms of, refreshed in terms of content anyways. Brexit, what am I going to quickly touch on is Brexit in general, what we know, what we don't know. I hope you don't know much more than I do, and I don't know a lot. I can tell you what we're doing at UBS after we go into this quickly. So obviously, when we go back to this picture, now we're looking at everything that doesn't apply for the EU anymore because we're exiting the EU. Brexit, what do we know? The UK today is part of the EU, it won't be in the future. Today it has access to the single market, it won't have access to the single market in the future. Well-established financial services market in the future, probably still well-established, maybe not as well-connected. But what you also know is that the FCA will continue to ask firms to adhere to the laws that are currently implemented. So basically, today we've got MiFID, tomorrow we'll have MiFID. The difference is, however, that ESMA might change something in MiFID, maybe there's a MiFID 3, the UK doesn't automatically follow that. Also, there's a difference in we're adhering to a law and we see each other as part of the EU and part of the EEA. Things like traded on a trading venue means it's traded on an EU trading venue. If it's traded on a UK venue for ESMA, is it still traded on a trading venue or is it not traded on a trading venue? If the venues get equivalence, then yes, otherwise, no. Will there be other equivalence provisions, et cetera, et cetera? We know, obviously, ESMA is not going to be the regulator anymore. It's going to be the FCA only. Another thing is the FCA-approved service providers, so ARMS and APAS, for example, when we're looking at MiFID, the question is, are they still going to be approved by ESMA, so by the EEA? The FCA has said for at least a year, all APAs that are approved elsewhere in Europe can also provide services into the UK. The other way around, we haven't gotten a confirmation and we're not sure if that's going to happen. So in the case of a hard Brexit, it's just there's tons of stuff that's still open. So that's what we're getting to now. What don't we know? We actually don't know much. Will it happen? Most likely. When will it happen? Soon. We don't really know, as we heard yesterday. Is there a transition period? Hopefully. Hard Brexit, maybe. What's the content of the deal? What will be negotiated? All of that, we don't know. If we're looking at specific pieces in terms of regulation, I just want to go mention a couple of them quickly. So I already talked a little bit about the venue equivalence. So if this traded on a trading venue piece changes, then we'll have to make changes for post and pre-trade transparency. It'll change the waterfall in how we report. It'll change, obviously, the underlying data that goes into it. It will definitely change the trading obligation, which markets can we actually trade on. And coming from a Swiss bank, I feel that pain already because SIX doesn't actually officially, or it's now it has equivalence, but for the last couple of years, it's always been a bit of an iffy situation. Is there equivalence? Is there not? So basically, that means once a trade is traded on an EU venue, it cannot leave the EU venues anymore, which means it wouldn't be able to come back to either, you know, to the UK or to Switzerland in that matter. So we have to implement more and more rule engines to follow our trade flows and make sure it doesn't go to this market, it doesn't go to that market, etc. The APAs and APAs I've already mentioned. We've got one more point, the FERDS database. It's currently at ESMA, everybody connects to it in order to do the transaction reporting. That there will also be an instance on the FCA side that is being created at the moment. We don't know when that's actually going to come into effect. Another small change, the national client identifier for transaction reporting has certain requirements for EU and non-EU citizens. Once UK clients are not in the EU anymore, they would potentially have to be reported with their passport numbers rather than with their insurance numbers, which firms might not have on file. So those are the changes that are sort of in the detail of the regulation, but again, complexity. So we might end up having some more implementation costs here. What can the UK do after Brexit? Several options, none of them super satisfying, but we can work through subsidiaries, as I mentioned earlier, so set up subsidiaries in the EU and work through those. International agreements, bilateral, multilateral, a very lengthy process, but possible. You can work through exemptions, like Japan and Switzerland have done. Equivalents where possible, or sectoral agreements. There's actually no real precedence case for it yet. Switzerland is trying to do that, where you have an agreement for entire industries. So just for the financial services sector, you could have an agreement of sort of an equivalence between between the markets of two countries. Possibilities, but by the way, judging by the way this whole the Brexit negotiation is going, might be a while until we see some real solutions here. So now going on to UBS, the big tale of UBS Brexit. At some point about 2 years ago, there was a decision taken in the senior management levels on the UBS side that the two UK entities that we had weren't going to be two; there was only going to be one. One is called UBS Limited, and the other one is called UBS AG London Branch. UBS AG London Branch was supposed to be staying in the UK, serving the UK market. The limited business is being moved via a cross-border merger to our German entity, UBS Europe SE. Now, UBS Limited is a mainly investment banking entity. Almost all of our trade flows run at some point through UBS Limited. Now, the decision was taken, other divisions, so this is an IB entity, other divisions were asked, well, do you need a project, do you need a budget for Brexit, we're doing this merger, but don't worry about it, it's a lift and shift operation, you'll have the same services within Europe SE, and you know, we'll just run the trades through the same way. So everybody sort of said, well, nah, look, that's fine. You just do your thing and we'll deal with Brexit when it comes. So no project was set up on a global scale, really, for Brexit. There was a merger project on the IB side that was a proper merger operation, so that was actually well set up. But on the wealth management and asset management side, which are the other two divisions at UBS, nothing was happening. I was at the time the MiFID trading program lead, and we were sort of winding down the project. I was letting some people go, and I figured, well, look, I'll just do an impact assessment on this before everybody goes, and I have to do it all myself. So we realized, okay, you're taking out one entity that's a major execution hub for us, which changes the trade flows, and changing trade flows has a massive regulatory impact. So we did an impact assessment. I went, okay, look, guys, I need some money to implement this when this merger happens. And the answer was, well, first of all, it's not your job because you're not in the Brexit project. And second of all, there can't be any impact because we don't have any budget. Okay. All right. So I said, all right, fine. See no evil, hear no evil, speak no evil. Sort of went around saying, well, we really kind of should do something because we're going to be in breach. Then, about 3 months out, came the surprise effect. Surprise, surprise, there's Brexit, and surprise, surprise, there's an impact. At that point, people started realizing, okay, now we're taking out this entity, there might be some stuff to do. The way it was set up, it's one of those things, Brexit is something that affects everybody, and nobody's responsible for it, and nobody really wants it either. So nobody really wants to pay for it, have resources for it. And I'm telling you this, you know, it's one of those things. It obviously it's a struggle within the organization, and I think UBS is not the only bank that has these struggles. We are getting there, and we're not going to be non-compliant, but just to let you know how we got there. So, surprise effect. We started setting up projects for asset management, for wealth management, started trying to get budget, and at that point, people just went, you're the project lead for Brexit. And I said, well, actually, no, I'm MiFID, I just have some Brexit topics. No, you're Brexit. It says Brexit on your slide. You're Brexit. Okay. All right, so I ended up being Brexit. And then I had to run around and say, okay, look, what other impacts do I have? I'm pretty good with, you know, our team is very good with MiFID, is very good, you know, to a certain extent with EMIR, with some other regulations, but all the other stuff, I mean, there must be other stuff that's going on. So we started going around, and that's when the silo effect came in. You know, everybody just kind of looks at my function, my project, we're working with the status quo. When Brexit comes, Brexit can tell us what we need to do. But there is no Brexit that can tell you anyway. So that was that. And then came the ripple effect. We started finding out impacts. And with one impact came another impact and another impact and another impact. So if you look at this, that's basically our landscape, right? So we've got 13 booking centers, 5 major asset classes, and all of them, at some point, one way or another, end up at Limited, either through the Swiss hub, executed through Limited, or directly to Limited, right? And Limited had been our silver bullet all along, because Limited is neither ESE nor AG. ESE and AG are two main branches. So the big topic that came up was PVA, principal versus agent. Wealth management is an agent business. We're set up for an agent business. We don't do principal. We would have had to deal with, you know, spread versus commission and settlement and all of that. Now, there is a regulation in APAC that says if your first principal in the chain is in the same entity as the originating entity where the trade comes from, that entity is a principal. By taking out Limited, we were taking out our principal. That means that principal would be either in Europe as E or AG, and all trades originate either in Europe as E or AG. So we would have been in breach. So we had to find another solution. Thinking about how we can route trades to other entities, and then you end up having circular flows. You're starting in entity one, going to entity B, going to entity C, going back to B, going back to A. Then you have got a BEX problem, because the best execution, you can't just send flows around and charge money for it. It takes a long time. So you always have to justify why you're sending flows in-house somehow. Cut a long story short, a massive, complex disaster. So that is at some point we had our heads in a knot just trying to figure out where these trades actually go, and then for each product and each asset class you've got different ways of how these can flow, and you need to look at every single piece. So taking a country out, taking an entity out, all of a sudden just puts everything upside down. So what do? We set up a project, trade flows, then all the different regulatory impacts across the asset classes, and then for all the different locations. This is what the impact looked like. The impact that we were told in the beginning of the project was no impact, because it was just going to be a lift and shift, right? So it's just a perfect example of how we end up spending tons and tons and tons of money to deal with our own complexity. And that's sort of the here we're going back to the original point. I mean, when we're looking at tech, for one, it's like we've got two issues. One is the complexity, and two is the speed of the changes. And both of that has been supported by tech solutions, and that's the only way we can reduce cost, right? I'm running out of time. I'm quickly going to go into the sustainability piece, just so you know what's coming your way. The UN, so 193 nations decided, okay, we're going to decide on 17 sustainability goals, and we're going to implement that according to a UN sustainability agenda by 2030. And the way we're going to do that is by making sure that the investment or the capital that's out there is impact invested, so it's sustainable. And who's going to make sure that happens? The banks. Very easy. This is right out of the action plan from the EU Commission, this little picture. So, you know, it looks quite easy, right? Action plan was actually published March 8th. So what that would mean is essentially we would have to evaluate and assess which investment is sustainable and which is not. And we'd have to overlay that with our client's risk profile, with the market risk, with all the other regulations that we're already looking at. Now the problem here is that in this action plan, for one, the taxonomy was supposed to be published. There's no solid taxonomy yet. So in this action plan, these three goals were mentioned. They're all environmental, right? Nothing about poverty or hunger or health and well-being, quality of education. There's also no guidance on what happens when, you know, you make sure women are paid equally as equal as men, but you're polluting the environment. What's more important, right? There's nothing like that out there. There's also, right now, if you're looking at companies and you're saying, well, invest in this company because that's a sustainable company, companies do sustainability reporting. It's voluntary, and there's no standard for it. So it needs rating agencies to come up with information, with data that we can utilize. At this point, it'll be really hard for us to do, even though, I mean, there's already three proposals for regulations out there that suggest we need to implement this. But that's just on a side note. Again, another massive piece of complexity that we're going to have to deal with. My last point, I've got 1 minute, so my last point that I'm going to go into is, I mentioned it earlier, so when we implement a regulation, again, we're going back to complexity, right? When we're implementing a regulation in a bank, in the life cycle of a trade, it gets extremely complex. So if we're looking at this, it looks quite easy, right? So this is, we've got the pre-trade, trade, post-trade, so order comes in, gets executed, and then reporting happens, etc., etc. We've got the client, we've got the firm, we've got the whole infrastructure, and then we've got the data providers. So you overlay that with the reporting information flow, it looks like that. You overlay that with the external data providers that come in, it looks like that. You add the backflow to it, it looks like that. Yeah, the clearing flow to it, it looks like that. And all this information has got to flow in and out of the organization somehow, and it's got to, systems have to talk to one another, etc. And that's then what you're looking at when you're looking at MiFID trading requirements only. Right? So, again, going back to tech, going back to complexity, I think the value chain is going to break up, and this is the final point I'm going to make. The value chain in the financial services industry is definitely going to break up. We need to focus on what we're good at, and that I mean that in terms of the services. If we're good at providing a certain service for ourselves, be it a reporting, for example, we need to sell that outside. We need to focus on the markets that we want to serve. We can't be, you know, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but we can't be everywhere, because it's just too expensive. We can only be where we're making money and where we can actually serve the client without too much complexity, unless we've got all the tech to support it. But that is also important, that development, right? So that brings me to the end, essentially. I'm not going to go into that. You can, if you want, you can read all of that. Who, you know. So thank you for listening. I know that was a lot. Are there any questions?
You brought up a lot of complexity around Brexit, and you painted quite a bleak picture. In your opinion, what do you think Brexit might bring as a benefit to UBS, or your part of UBS? So I'm searching far and wide. I can't find any benefits myself, but Maybe
yeah,
that's
I mean,
just
look,
me
that's a good question.
But have you guys at least identified one benefit? Just one. Just give us one.
Look, I'm there to solve problems, not to. Well, look, I think, I mean, if you obviously, if you do it right, you're in an advantage, right? If you manage to focus on the UK market, if you stay flexible. But in terms of the Brexit, what's the Brexit going to do good for UBS? I don't see anything at this point. Sorry. If I come up with something, I will let you know. Does anybody else have an idea? Yes, go ahead.
If a Brexit wasn't to happen, yeah. What have you learned from this whole process about your organisation?
That we all need to see the big picture, and we can't work in silos. That hierarchies are way too. We're too segregated in our complexity. I think we need to. We need to all understand more of our business. We need to understand our organization, and we need to think as an entrepreneur and not as one person in one department. And I've learned this from Brexit. I've also learned it from MiFID. We've got more and more external influences that affect the entire organization, and we need to see that. And operational risk needs to play a part in strategy. Like, we can't just be there checking boxes and making sure people do the right thing. I think we need to be there anticipating what's going to come and where the firm is going to have to go. That's a personal learning. Hopefully some other people have learned that as well. Oh, God. If I was Theresa May, I'd hand in my resignation. But what would be the key factors you would negotiate in order to limit the complexity and impact of Brexit to financial services firms? I think I would try to go towards a mix of equivalent and sectorial agreement. So in my opinion, the FCA has been the driving regulator in the EU. Like, the FCA is, like, from experience, the FCA is the one that's most vocal, that's the most interactive, that's the most clear. The FCA is communicative. I mean, you try and you reach out to BaFin, you'll never get an answer, right? The FCA comes back and they enter into discussions. So I think the EU would be stupid to lose that. I would make that point if I was Theresa May and would say, okay, look, let's try and find a sectorial agreement. We've implemented all these regulations together. Let's go forward with this, and let's create equivalence provisions, and let's set a new precedence of how we could make this work. Does that answer the question? I don't know who asked it. Yes.
Yes, on the UN sustainability goals that you mentioned, how much impact do you think that will have on internal processes, systems, and decisions?
Massive. So I wasn't actually a big part of the investor protection implementation, but it will affect the entire evaluation of the of the appropriateness of advice. So the entire advice process will change, because you always have to look at not only is this product right for my client and for the risk profile of my client, you also have to make sure it's okay for Africa and it's okay for you know, the environment and all of that. And how do you assess that? So you need to get data feeds in, which means you have to change internal structures, and those internal structures have to be connected to the client data, to the product data, to the transaction data, to the trade flow. So everything, again, has to have another level of connection and transparency within it. Yeah. I think it's going to be a nightmare, to be honest. A nightmare to control as well.
Thank you for listening to our podcast on risk regulation and sustainability in 2019 from our recent Trading Tech Summit. For more content on trading technology from A-Team Group, you can visit ateaminsight.com, where you can also sign up for our next Trading Tech Summit, which will be held in New York City on June 11th, 2019, and is free of charge for financial institutions.